welcome to Green Zine here at WFVRLP in South Royalton, Vermont. I'm fiddling with buttons and switches and mouses and links and everything else here as we bring you your weekly environmental radio digest of all kinds of topics, and we are going to touch on a lot of topics today. Hey, before I play a little bit of music for you, and then bring Henry Swayze onto the air, we do want to thank Solaflec. They are the solar tracking company based down in Norwich, Vermont. Bale, long-running nonprofit based here on the Commons in South Royalton. Find out more about their activities and informational links at balevt.org. Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz. Yeah, I bet he's riding his bike this weekend. Upper Pass Beer Company, the First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, and I'm still trying to pin down that date for next summer. They're going to bring back a two-day Solar Fest with camping and music and all kinds of environmental education, most likely in August of 2025. The White River Land Collaborative, who just had a successful raffle as a fundraiser as they attempt to purchase the land that they are based on in Tunbridge, just over the border from Royalton. And they need to come up with, well, a lot of money. But they're on their way. And then a breakfast and lunch restaurant in Randolph, Vermont, named Wit and Grit. What's that sound I hear? It sounds like maybe crickets and some bugs. Some bugs are out there. We need more bugs here on Green Zine.
The junior bug comes in the month of June. The lightning bug comes in May. Bed bug comes just any old time, but ain't not going to stay. Oh, there ain't no bugs on me. There ain't no bugs on me. There may be bugs on the rest of you mugs, but there ain't no bugs on me.
Henry, how's the bug population where you are today?
Well, I was just researching the triple E, equine encephalitis,
yes,
to see what's been happening. And I guess they're finding it in mosquitoes, but it's not we aren't getting a lot of additional human interactions. At least
not many people getting infected.
Not, yeah, telling us about them if it's happening.
Yeah, I think somebody was diagnosed with getting that disease in New Hampshire. I'm not sure there's been a case yet in Vermont, but they certainly
have been two deaths in Vermont.
Okay, two deaths. All right.
Yeah.
So we'll start with gloom and doom early. Watch out. There's still mosquitoes in Vermont, and you should probably go inside. But still, a serious issue.
So our bird note is all about the positive side of insects, and
yes,
and so and it comments that most insects are positive. They're essential for our ecosystem to work, and they're part of that bird note and on. Our theme for today's show is keeping ecosystems thriving, with a special focus on forest. But we'll get into those details as we get into the show.
All right. Well, let's go. Insects are essential, and here's more proof of that from Bird Note on Green Zine.
This is Bird Note. A tiny Nashville warbler flies to its nest, a fat caterpillar clamped in its beak. Nearly all of North America's smaller birds, from this warbler to chickadees to thrushes, raise their young on insects, especially insect larvae, like this juicy caterpillar. Insects sustain our ecosystems, and not just as a food source. They also pollinate 90% of all plants. And without plants at the heart of the food web, life on Earth would simply collapse. Though insects are small, easily overlooked and often vilified, most are beneficial. But their numbers have dropped by half in the last 50 years, so it's now critical to help foster insects. One concrete way to help is to grow native plants that provide food and shelter for insects like caterpillars. For example, in the eastern United States and Midwest, buttonbush supports 18 different species of caterpillars and also provides food for birds in the form of nectar and seeds. Growing such plants directly benefits birds and helps insects keep the natural world ticking. Contact a local master gardener to help you find what's best for your area. Begin at birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Well, that was very nice. Very nice singing as well. And that is a juicy caterpillar here on the picture, Henry.
Yes, I guess all caterpillars probably look juicy to birds. Haven't developed an appetite for eating them myself yet.
No, but hey, may come to that. Yeah.
I think there are many cultures that treasure their insect snacks. Crickets and all nature of things are roasted and crunchy, good eating. I haven't indulged in that. I have to broaden my food horizons.
Yeah, I read a fictional book that was set not that far into the future, and it took place mostly in Florida, which was getting flooded in the book, like constantly, and people just getting used to putting their house up on stilts. And then at the other end in California, where there was just burning going on all the time. And the mother of one of the characters lives in California, and she got into cricket farming at home and served that rather than a meat. She served these toasted crickets as a sort of a topping for some other kind of natural foods. And it took a while for the guest to get used to it, but it kept coming back. I think about three or four times during the course of that book, she was ready to serve up some insects. But our insects are really in decline, Henry. Have you noticed a big difference other than some of these late season mosquitoes that are hanging around?
They are in decline, and that's been a long-term piece. And as the bird note thing piece said, you can plant things that are, get a hold of a master gardener who can help you figure out what to plant to get more insects. And I, I have a little mowed section in front of my house in Tunbridge, but I leave the rest of the field, partly because I don't have a sheep to eat it anymore. And it has right now lots of goldenrod in it, and goldenrod makes pretty nasty honey, but it is something for the bees to store more food for the winter with. And I have quite a lot of milkweed in there, which helps with the
monarch
butterflies.
Yeah, the monarch butterflies love milkweed. Yeah,
spacing monarchs.
Yeah,
it's. I'm sure it's got lots of other critters in there. I haven't gone out and inventoried them. But wall-to-wall lawn, wall-to-wall anything isn't good for nature. You need diversity. So I have a piece that Dee Dee Pursehaus wrote. She has a blog, the Wisdom Underground, and this is a piece. The part I'm going to read, she posted from it's an older writing that she brought back up, and I think it's quite lovely, and I'm going to attempt to read it. Not my best thing reading. Other species are essential workers. Those economies enfold our own. And no, this is not an endorsement of the financialization of nature. And the article after this piece I'm going to read goes on to being aware of the financialization of nature, which us capitalists are prone to financialize anything we can see that moves. So there's a picture, a lead essential worker, dung beetles, who literally cut up cow pies, etc., and roll them into little marble-sized balls, and then move them around and get them to a nice location, dig a hole, and bury them. So they are recycling the nutrients and giving it back to the soil. And it's a very valuable piece of how a pasture ecosystem works. Okay, so on to her text. Prelude. Just up the road from here, essential workers are building a series of small dams to prevent flooding in the towns downstream from me. They're using a technology that allows fish to travel upstream, filters out pollutants from water flowing through, and captures eroding soil from nearby farms. Over time, the dams will naturally disintegrate in random series, leaving behind fertile soil already seeded with plants to provide a large soil sponge that can capture rain without the need for further dams. They've been working nights recently to avoid getting in the way of traffic. Other parts of the essential workforce have been performing the design of solar-powered oxygen pumps that simultaneously function as air conditioners, air purifiers, food production units. If we had enough of them, we could easily feed every living thing on the planet. These pumps also produce raw materials for construction and clothing while collecting CO2 from the air and storing it safely above ground. And we'll be getting into those tree-like structures further on in the program. The pharmaceutical wing of this workforce has figured out how to switch on brain development in utero and synthesize vitamins from simple foods. It can also now create and deliver the exact dosage of antidepressants and immune-boosting chemicals for each person's needs at exactly the time they need them. These workers, designers, patent holders, and investors are not humans. They're the myriad species with whom we share our landscape, animals, plants, fungi, bacteria, and other microbes. If they all went on strike, we would have no oxygen to breathe, no food to eat. Most rainfall would cease. Dead animals and plants would pile up miles high, with no way to break them down into raw materials for continued life. Temperature regulation on Earth would deteriorate to the point that it would become uninhabitable. Meanwhile, our own human brains and bodies would cease to function. These essential workers get no pay, no health insurance, no workers' compensation if they are injured. In fact, in most countries, they have no legal rights at all. They can be bought, enslaved, and enslaved by the highest bidder, forced to work under terrible conditions, have limbs cut off, and be killed when they are deemed unnecessary to production. Yet they build the infrastructure and provide the goods and services that underpin every economy on Earth. And she goes on in this to warn about the ignoring of that of that infrastructure and running roughshod over it without regard to its destruction in our trying to make a more affluent economy for ourselves. 'Tis at our own peril. So that's kind of the lead-in for this show.
And just to remind people, those were the words and writings of she's been on the air and co-hosted the show once or twice, Dee Dee Pursehouse, and I believe she's over, is she in Stratford or Thetford over that way?
She's in Thetford.
Okay.
And the link for this whole piece, all these links are up already on the show blog, down in the link section. And you can sign up for her subtract. She puts something out every week or two, and always thoughtful, and always, I think, very much on target for hey, what are we ignoring, and what should we be paying attention to? How do you put Humpty Dumpty back together again?
Yeah. Before we leave this, though, I'm looking. I want to point people out. They should definitely go to the link, and it references that this piece was taken from a piece that she wrote in 2020 for the Regenerative Economy Collaborative. And to continue on in that next paragraph, as far as our hyper-capitalistic world goes, she writes on, markets have sprung up for various ecosystem services. Now, when we just hear that part, it sounds pretty good. But those markets can grab and hoard land, gamble on water futures, set up banking systems involving endangered species and their habitats, and carbon trading that is often fraudulent. In other words, an example of that would be, oh, don't worry about it. We've got a carbon credit for flying, you know, across to Europe on a big jet, leading to more ecosystem devastation without climate benefit. All this to grow human wealth under the guise of protecting what nature does for humans and human businesses. Just as we need to radically shift our economy and society toward non-extractive relationships with human workers, we need to adjust our relationships with the biological workforce as well. So just a few more words from Dee Dee. Very, very good article here, Henry.
Yes. Yeah. It's she's on it.
Yeah. That wasn't a good sound. That sounded like Henry dropped out. But we're always trying to be ready here in case something goes amiss. And let's check in on the bugs and see if Henry's going to call me back.
Looking up at the sky, the lily pad broke and the frog fell in. He got water all in his eyeball. There ain't no bugs on me. There ain't no bugs on me. There may be bugs on some of you mugs, but there ain't no bugs on me.
I think there was a bug in the phone wire, Henry.
There was. I think it was a nasty bug instead of one of those eco-friendly ones.
Well, anyway, he must have jumped off the line, and now you're back on the line. Great.
Yes. I heard a little dump, and I thought, well, maybe I'm not talking to anyone anymore. I better look.
Yeah, well, you know, in this political season, there are couch surfing gremlins out there searching the internet for ways to change things around. But you're with Green Scene here.
I'm surprised I'm big enough fish for them to tackle me.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah.
So I was saying that I've been over in the White Mountains getting my glider out of the woods, which is safely back at Post Mills. And that gave me a chance to, you know, I went in there, I don't know, 4-5 times, I guess. And it gave me a chance to kind of look at the forestry management that they are doing.
Mm.
And even on the very steep ridge where my plane was, something you'd never think would be logged. There really weren't any very large trees. Stuff up to 14 inches, maybe 16 inches, but nothing 20 and 40 inches in diameter. Mm. Nothing that had been around for 150 or 200 years. And they're basically doing in that forest, and I was really surprised to see it on that steep ground, they are doing forest management. And I believe that it is very heavily designed to maximize the amount of wood taken out.
Yes.
To try and make that forest produce the most saw timber that you can. And that's the mandate that the Forest Service has to work under. And I think they're doing a very good job of it. But there are very few old trees. And that brings me to the next piece, which is a piece that we're not going to play any of, but it's a presentation, and again, it's in the links. It's forest management for climate instead of for money. And it's by Dr. William Mumal, who I thought was going to be on doing a presentation last night that I attended a meeting, but he turned out not to attend that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to get him to come on GreenZine, and we'll probably have him in the future.
Oh, good.
But this presentation was done in 2021. And it's a very, very good description of the services that forests provide. And the two biggest takeaways that I saw, well, maybe even three, but the points that I took away that I wanted to include this for people to go to is that as forests get older, as they have more and more mature trees in them, two things happen. One is that their annual rate of pulling carbon out of the atmosphere actually gets bigger and bigger every year. So the Forest Service says, well, we can grow maximum amount of board feet of wood if we keep the forests much younger, keep them all nothing over mature, nothing that it's got any woodpecker holes in it.
Yeah.
And he's pointing out that that the forest actually has sequesters more carbon every year, that the young growths are putting on a lot of wood growth, but they aren't sequestering as much carbon as a forest that's been left to grow. And then the amount of carbon sequestered over time, if you're not cutting them down, becomes enormous. It is a great big carbon sink. We are pulling a lot of CO2 out of the atmosphere. And as Dee Dee Pursehaus is saying in her piece, we're also providing ourselves with oxygen and clean air. And she doesn't get into that in that piece, but we're also driving the rain cycle. We're making it so that we're cooling at ground level and getting frequent light rainfalls instead of big downpours. It's a turn off the boom and bust rain cycle that we seem to be living in, where we go from drought to way too much rain and then back to drought. So that the first point was that they are carbon sinks and that they actually pull carbon down faster when they are bigger. And the other pieces, he has a map in there, in that presentation, which shows where the most carbon is stored in the woods, basically where the woods are the biggest. And it's showing it for all of New England, and he says in the presentation that it's that the area in along the Green Mountains, the area in the border region, the plateau, wooded plateau between southern Vermont and northern Massachusetts,
yes,
is among the densest forests anywhere, not only in New England, but most of the way down the East Coast and out west, maybe to Wyoming.
Hmm.
And that when you look at that map, if you look at the area up in the Northeast Kingdom and the area over in New Hampshire on the other side, that area actually doesn't have very much carbon density. And it's because of three wood-burning power plants, the one in Burlington, the one in, well, it was one in New Hampshire and another one in Vermont. And those three wood-burning power plants are taking a lot of biomass out of those woods and burning them. And that's the trend, is to move, to think of biofuels as being the new source of energy. Instead of looking at, instead of emphasizing wind and solar and things that are not consuming or any emitting carbon. So that's it. And this kind of all became a focus because there is a gasification plant that has been approved for Lindenville,
yes,
Vermont, right up in that Northeast Kingdom area.
Sort of a fast-forwarded, like it's a high-speed effort to get that built and maybe, yeah, not necessarily having to go through all the rulemaking and prerequisites that other plants have had to go through.
Right. And I went to a Vermont 350 meeting last night talking about it, and their push is to get the I think it's the Public Service Board. I'm sorry, I'm spacing the agency,
yeah,
responsibility.
The PUC. PUC, I believe.
PUC.
Yep.
Is that the Public Service Commission, I guess it is?
Public Utilities Commission. Yeah, they changed the
public
name.
Utilities.
That's what's confusing. It used to be the Public Service Board. Now it's called the PUC. Yep.
All right. PUC. And you should weigh into the PUC, and that can be very useful in terms of switching this out. What's happening is this gasification plant, which is not a clean plant, but it's small enough so it's allowed to fly under the radar and be run as an experiment. And it's going to have the benefit, we've mentioned this I think last week, of producing biochar, which can be very useful for cleaning up Superfund sites and for and as a soil amendment, especially when it is combined with compost. But it has the problem that this is going to, because it's going to be a stationary plant, it's going to draw from the woods around it, and it isn't just going to be using waste product. It's going to actually land up using a lot of material removed from the landscape for the purpose of feeding it. And it's being fast-tracked. It's being put through without any look at the implications and what happens to its neighbors, and to the what happens with air pollution, and is there any air pollution monitoring, and all those things are basically going to be given a wave, and we want Vermont 350, and my role in that, at least I personally want, I guess all of Vermont 350 has come out, at least on the side of saying, we want it to be a full review. We want to actually look at those details rather than just fast track it and have virtually no public comment and just kind of get the thing built so we can find out if it works. And the problem, even though it is small, with letting it get built is that it will receive federal funding. These units don't tend to survive on their own without funding. And it is a model to go out and replicate, take it to Wall Street money, let them invest in it, and build plants all across the forested portion of our country as a way of generating income. It's profitable if it has those federal inputs. And I think there's good to be had from it. But there's also bad, and I just don't think it has not been evaluated properly. So that's kind of the overview on feedback loops and
well, a word that's sticking in my head from Dee Dee's piece that you were reading from. And then what you were just saying about if this project got up and running and it was seen by the federal government worthy of subsidizing, and then there were chances for investors to come in and say, hey, we're helping the green economy because we're making by putting money, and then we're who knows what percentage they might get back out again. And who knows whether they really care about the environment and not using or doing over extraction. And that's one thing also that occurred to me earlier in this discussion, Henry, is that using wood and, you know, biomass plants, et cetera, one of the big differences, and whether you want to say that's at least greener than using fossil fuels, is that it is another extractive industry. And as you noticed over there in the National Forest in New Hampshire, where your glider was, that That's not being done to really help carbon capture. It's being done to say, well, we're saving logging jobs in the state of New Hampshire. So to go to data-driven analytics and to economics, is there are certainly ways that models can predict over 20 years whether it's let this forest grow for the next 20 years, what's the level of carbon capture as opposed to the current cutting down of certain tracts of forests? And what is the value of that economically, not necessarily into some investor's pocket, but to the general public? What the carbon capture part of that? And does that actually exceed the value of lost logging jobs, et cetera? And I would argue it probably does if you look at it that way, but we don't really have an economic analysis like that. And we have things that are happening way too quickly that should be looked at a lot more closely, like this plant in Lindenville.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. And the problem is that it's based on the narrow lens of, well, what are the economics of the wood, not what are the costs of treating forests this way.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no price for carbon, and you know the Biden administration has mandated that all of the government, the federal government bodies take the carbon accounting, the greenhouse gas accounting, into their decision-making process. But it really hasn't worked its way down through the regulations. and it's not being, you know, if the Forest Service were to be told that they need to manage those woods with a primary goal of, or at least to bring carbon into the accounting process, they would have a different management plan. And I bet they would do a great job with it. The problem is that we aren't asking to do the right thing, and I think that's true of this is shooting from the hip. I haven't read the mandate to the Vermont Forest Service for managing state lands here, and certainly there is a movement just to say, well, if this is state lands, let's do the right thing with it and let it grow up. There's another article. I put up a link to this. I don't think I put a link into this of the National Forest starting to go in to actually cut old growth forests. Cut the older stands in a series of places, the Sandwich Mountains and places here in New England, and they've got thousands of acres ready to get, you know, building new roads to get in there and basically tear the place apart in order to have more bored feet. I think it's something that requires pushback. I think we need to, the step we can take right now is to go to the PUC and shut off this demand for biomass by saying let's see this Lindenville plant go through a full.
It's like an environmental impact statement that takes into account, you know, the building of it initially, but also what are the long term ramifications for our non-human built environment. Hey, Henry, let's shift gears. Unless you have one more comment, because we've got about 22 minutes. No, okay. We're going to fast forward to next week at least briefly, because it's going to be a very interesting three-way discussion. With Jim Merkel, who wrote the seminal book that came out several years ago, maybe 20 years ago, Radical Simplicity, and he served at Dartmouth as one of the first sort of professors. I don't know if he was called a professor. We'll ask him next week whether he wants to be called Professor Merkel, but he was ahead of a sustainability division there at Dartmouth, which was kind of groundbreaking, particularly for a rather conservative education institute like Dartmouth. And he has just finished up a new film, and I have the trailer here, and I think there's enough good audio in this. It's about 3.5 minutes long. He is taking it to various film festivals, and as of a little email exchange with some good friends of Jim's and of my partner and me, there's a good chance that this film may be getting screened for the public, and we've got some ideas where that may happen, maybe even here at the law school. And that would be in November. So that's kind of in the works. But here is a trailer of Jim Merkel's. Henry, would you have a comment?
Before you play that trailer, the trailer may explain this. But what he's done is said, how do you he's been on this quest for how do you stop having such a big human footprint on the earth? And he searched out places around the world that have been successful in doing this. So it's not just tighten your seatbelt and grim and bear it. It's make the system work for everybody. So let's go to the trailer and see if
they
explain that.
Visit and if we need more explanation, we'll have the film director and also, of course, the author.
Absolutely, he'll be 100% here.
Yeah. All right, here we go with the trailer for Jim Merkel's new film, Saving Walden's World.
Who start wars? Men in suits. Who decide about politics and strategies? Mainly men in suits.
provided those machines and the software to those people.
I did.
I did, too. So you say, sure, I would never tell a secret. And you're 24 years old and out of engineering school, and then you're faced with selling Aris to, like, 50 countries. And at the time, we had 50 covert operations going on, and they're all meant to destabilize countries, to pump up some faction with a lot of weaponry who is favorable to U.S. business interests. And in a sense, I had an ethical crisis.
That's calcium.
Oh, little calcium deposits.
Calcium is very light, so it floats on liquids.
Since becoming a father, the stakes feel higher all the time.
Our future generations are really in a pickle if we don't change the course of what we're doing.
Wow, it feels great.
I was researching for years, where can we find examples of sustainability, of low footprint societies that are having small families? And from the data, I picked out this society in Kerala, India, Cuba, and Slovenia. I was being paid to undermine places like Cuba and Kerala. And how ironic that they happen to be among the most sustainable societies on Earth.
In Kerala, they overthrew an order which was unbelievably repressive.
It was actually powered by people demanding for more equality, more rights, more access to healthcare and education.
Gobierno cubano por haberme hecho médico.
It's proven that in societies when there is more equality, they are more sustainable.
Que una de las de los fuertes justamente la justicia social. Y dentro de la justicia social está ese cuidado del ambiente.
Empower the women, then they are able to go and talk to the others and change society as a whole.
We see a wholesome life. We see really happy people living on a fraction of the footprint.
We dream about not our nation, not our country, not our place, but dream of whole world.
What I discovered on my journey is the most beautiful force in action. Empowered women acting with what they have power over to avert the greatest catastrophe our world has ever faced. If we wanted to short circuit the sixth extinction, we would have to leave about half the planet in a wild condition to reverse this time we're in. Humans can pull it off, but we have to get busy working.
You're talking to a new woman here.
Well, I'm hooked after listening to that and also seeing some stuff. There was a quote in there in a subtitle from an Indian woman, and she said, "And care for the environment is social justice." I really like that little quote from her. Yeah, so that we'll be talking with the film's director. He's all over this. I noticed that in one of the clips, Henry, he was wearing a Common Ground Country Fair, one of my favorite environmental, sustainable ag-based festivals in the country. It takes place, it might even be this coming weekend, in Unity, Maine. So look up the Common Ground Fair if you want to hang out with a bunch of cool people.
Yes. I used to go to that.
Yeah, I'll bet you did.
I was electric fencing. I was that business. I had a booth at that.
Oh, maybe we need to take Green Zine on the road and do a live remote from the Common Ground Country Fair. What do you think? We'll talk to Jim about it.
Major undertaking.
Oh, we're into major undertaking. Yeah.
It'd be good.
It would be good.
Yeah.
All right. So that the gentleman that was quoted in there, you heard his voice several times. Jim Merkel will be on with us on Green Zine next week. Yeah, go ahead, Henry.
Yes. Yeah. So maybe we'll put the woods back. Leave that portion alone. I haven't done. I'm still searching for numbers, but I'd say that that forests have the ability to do more forest in curing the environment and especially climate change than farmers' fields even.
Mm-hmm.
A lot can be done with changing farming practices, but I think the woods may be ahead of it all. So how do these changes happen? So you get the Forestry Service managing forests. You get the different boards figuring out where our energy is going to come from and what we're going to have for our electric supply and for our vehicle supply, whether we move to electric. I think the move to electric is going to happen whether we want it to or not, because electric cars, as they get more and more affordable and more charging is available, will become the real car of choice. It will be what you want to drive, not what would be good for the environment to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And all those levers for making those things happen happen because of what agencies, I mean, at least I shouldn't say all of them, but a big lever for this is what government does and what long-term strategies are laid out. And it's interesting to look at the power of voting. And right now, and this, again, there's a link for this, Catherine Hayhoe piece on 40% of young voters will not vote for a candidate who does not have climate as a high priority. So that's a pretty heavy percentage that are saying, I'm not going to vote for you at all if you don't have your hand up for the climate. The problem is that those young voters don't vote very regularly.
No.
And politicians who are polling voters, and they don't poll non-voters, they only poll voters, they don't find people who have climate change up as a high priority, and therefore they don't make it a high priority for them to take action on climate. They may get pushed to it by the amount of flood damage or fire damage they're getting in the state, that they have to pay some attention to it, but they're sort of dragged kicking and screaming to it because they don't think their voters care about it. And so this next piece I want to run is a cartoon, but it plays pretty well on air without the visuals. And it's an introduction to the Environmental Voter Protection organization. So this is an organization that's about getting out the vote and particularly focusing on the voters who say that climate is their highest priority, but only sometimes vote.
Yes. So, yeah, the youth vote, the 18 to 35 vote is traditionally the lowest percentage turnout. And I do have this on the screen. I see some windmills. I see a very healthy whale going across the ocean. And let's go ahead and play it. The Environmental Voter Project. Here we go. You're listening to Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio.
Meet Lily. She cares deeply about the planet her kids will inherit. And she knows that climate change and other environmental problems are only getting worse. So Lily does what she can. She recycles. She bikes to work, even in winter. But there's one thing Lily doesn't do that could have the biggest impact of all. Lily doesn't vote. And she's not alone. The latest research reveals that most people who really care about the environment, as many as 15 million environmentalists, simply don't vote. That's a huge problem, because by and large, politicians only care about the needs of people who vote. To figure out those needs, politicians conduct lots and lots of polls. But they only poll people who vote regularly, because only voters decide whether politicians keep their jobs. Even worse, political campaigns never even encourage people like Lily to vote because it's more efficient to just reach out to reliable voters. The end result? When Lily and the 15 million environmentalists like her don't vote, their concerns don't show up in polls, and so politicians ignore them. We have to change this. For Lily and her family, for you and your family, and for the planet. That's where the Environmental Voter Project comes in. We're not a campaign, and we don't even care who gets elected. We're a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization with a simple mission: get more environmentalists to vote in each and every election. Here's how we'll do it. First, we'll use state-of-the-art data analytics to precisely identify all the Lilies out there who deeply care about the environment but are ignored by politicians. Then we'll connect with them, knocking on doors, using social media, and sending mailings, all with special messages scientifically proven to increase their likelihood of voting. Eventually, as more environmentalists vote, they'll show up in polls too, making environmental issues impossible to ignore. So what's next? Well, that depends on you. Join our movement today, and together, we'll make sure that every environmentalist votes in every election. With your help, we can give Lily and millions like her a voice. A voice that just might save the planet.
Yeah, the environmentalvoter.org is the website to find out more about that environmental voter project. Very, very good graphics in there. I think you could show that to your five-year-old and they would get the message. I like how they had the United States pictured and they had all the red states and all the blue states outlined. And then suddenly they turned all green, Henry. Boy, would that be a miracle?
Yes. Well, it'd be awfully nice to have people working together instead of against one another.
Yeah, we have enough of that going on, that's for sure. Yeah, good. Good
so,
stuff.
So I put my hand up for this. This is something you can go directly to the Environmental Voter Protection group and work with that, but Citizens Climate Lobby has focused on this, and they're doing two postcard writing sessions. So there will be scripts that are already designed for the picked out as being the things that is most influential of getting voters to the polls. Very short messages to write on those cards, and the cards, and there's names and addresses, and the cards will go to only people who have climate as a high priority and don't vote regularly. So it's a targeted audience. And I put my hand up to address some of those cards, and there are two addressing parties going on. There is one, they're both of them on Saturday. One of them is in Wilder, and it starts at 9:30 in the morning. and the other is in Burlington, and it is starting at, I believe, 7 o'clock in the evening. I'm almost certain that's correct. And there are, in the notes, there are contact people for both of those card-writing sessions. And you also, with either of those people, you also can get involved. Card writing is just one of the things that the Environmental Voter Protection group does. Another thing they do is they actually go door to door and canvass people, again, to addresses of people who are sometimes climate voters. And so they're targeting the people we want to get to the polls, make it a regular thing to get to the polls. And so you can go knock on doors and encourage them to vote. You don't have to ask them anything about what they think about the environment or anything else. You just need to say, hey, you know, your voice is your power. I want to make sure you get to the poll. Did you know that you can vote locally here, you know, how you get yourself to the poll and do that. And then another thing is to do the same thing by the telephone, so there can be telephone banking.
Right.
Cards seem like a good place for me to start, even though I would probably enjoy the door-to-door thing. The people I know who have gone door-to-door for VPIRG or for other things to do with environmental issues have really enjoyed the process of doing that. So go to the notes and you can get those potential things.
Yeah, and here's something that's not in the notes on the EV front as we wind into our final 3 minutes of the show, and we're going to bring the bugs back just before the show ends. A couple of EV things, one happening tonight if you're in the Norwich area, down at the community room at the Norwich Public Library from 6:30 to 7:30, a program called Road Tripping with an EV. I've done that. Wonder what it's like to take a road trip in an EV. Will the trips you need take to be compatible with an EV? Road trips are not the only consideration in becoming an EV driver. Two EV drivers will be there with firsthand experience. No, I will be in the Norwich area, but not at this event. One of them drives a VW ID4 and one drives a Chevy Bolt. Something even more local than that is the Forward Festival is happening this Saturday in Bethel, Vermont. It's a big deal over there. Bethel's a happening town, and they will have their EV Expo for about the fifth year in a row. I understand some new vehicles that are just out on the market will be there at the large parking lot in downtown Bethel. I'm sure there, I bet you there'll be a Rivian there. It might not be mine. There might be some Bolts, probably some Teslas, but some ID4s, etc. And you can talk to drivers directly about their experience with those EVs. And I see I wanted to start this music, and I've got one more thing, which is to acknowledge our underwriters, and then I may turn it back to you, Henry, if there's time. Yeah, here come the bugs. Green Zine is brought to you today at WFERLP South Royalton by the White River Land Collaborative in Tunbridge, Wit and Grit Restaurant in Randolph, Solaflect based down in Norwich, Vermont, Bale, right on the Commons here in South Royalton, Royal Trailworks, thank you, Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, and another business located on the green here in South Royalton, in case you need a jolt of Joe, the First Branch Coffee Company. Got about a minute left, Henry.
I just have one quick thing from Carol Langstaff.
Probably about plastic.
She's among other things, the plastics lady.
Yes.
Let's figure out how to get rid of it. A lot of plastics are consumed at Halloween, and so again, in our notes, I have her little plastic tips, and it's how to do a kind of plastic-free Halloween costume design and get creative and have fun without using plastic.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Halloween, just around the corner. I think it's 6 weeks away. Do you have your costume picked out, Henry?
Well, I looked at those sites and I saw some fun things to do. Big, big cardboard boxes converted into uniforms.
All right. We'll probably have a book review for you next week. And we're spending a good part of our show with film director and writer Jim Merkel. Henry, always good to hang with you. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Here at Royalton Community Radio.
Bye-bye.